officially convene us.
Meeting will come to order. We don't quite have a quorum yet, but we're going to get started here, and as soon as we have a quorum, we'll take care of the minutes. And this is the February 1st meeting of the Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee. And today we have a couple of overviews. First from the Department of Administration, the B3 project presentation, and appreciate you coming back from the other day. I know you ran out of time. And then the second half hour here will be the Minnesota State Board of Investment. And members, I'm hoping to adjourn the meeting today in about an hour, about 11:20 or so. And then we'll have at least two bills tomorrow, at least two bills the next day, and I think it'll start moving a little faster here, hopefully bills every day next week. So with that, let's have the folks up from the Department of Admin then for the B3 project. And now do we have a quorum? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee.
And we can't quite hear you.
Better?
Just need to move over a little bit, yeah. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee. For the record, my name is Nikki Giancola. I am the Assistant Commissioner of Facilities in the Department of Administration.
Welcome.
Thank you. About a week ago, I think it was, Representative Tindleston contacted me about giving a short presentation to this committee on the concept of sustainability. I'm fairly new to state government, so I really wasn't for sure what we had on the topic, but I was fairly confident that we could put something together for you that would be interesting and hopefully educational. I'm by no means an expert on this topic, but I assure you I have folks with me from the department and beyond who have background on this and work with this in their position. The term sustainability, to me, really means to build and maintain for the future. I'm guessing that a lot of you have probably heard some of the buzzwords currently associated with this concept, such as green building, LEED, Energy Star rated, environmentally preferable products and services, but it's not really such a new concept. I think what's happened recently is a natural response to the energy crisis of the 70s and the resulting concerns of, say, indoor air quality, sick building syndrome, that kind of thing. And as a result, there's been developed a system of guidelines, certifications, and product ratings. And just kind of as a lead into the heart of this presentation, I'd just like to introduce to you the state's project that addresses this concept of sustainability. The B3 project, better known as Buildings, Benchmarks, and Beyond, was conceived in 2001 as a way to reduce the amount of energy used by new and existing public buildings in the state of Minnesota. The project has two components, the first being sustainable guidelines, which facilitate the design of new high-performance buildings having lower life cycle costs, and the second piece is benchmarking, which identifies existing buildings least efficient in their use of energy, and the concept here is that money spent on improving these buildings will save the most money in future energy costs. The benchmarks and guidelines have been developed at no cost to the state's general fund. Funding is through an assessment on 22 utility companies, and $500,000 a year approximately is available through fiscal year 06 for this work. The Departments of Administration and Commerce, with the assistance of other agencies, developed these sustainable building guidelines and the energy benchmarks. And the guidelines must exceed existing energy code by at least 30%. They need to focus on achieving the lowest possible lifetime costs for new buildings and encourage continual energy conservation improvements in new buildings. With that, I'd like to now turn this over to Linda Kane and Rajan Thomas. Linda Kane is the project manager in the State Architect's Office and will cover in more depth the sustainable building guidelines. Rajan is an engineer in our Energy Management Services Department in the Plant Management Division, and he will talk about the energy benchmarking activity and goal. Both these folks were core team members on the original B3 project.
Thank you. And before we take that up, we'd like to get a little business done here in the committee. We now have a quorum. Representative Neil Pearson.
Madam Chair, I have reviewed the minutes from the meeting of January 27, and to the best of my understanding, they fill the criteria of that meeting, and I'll move their approval.
Thank you, Representative Pearson. Representative Neil Pearson moves the minutes of the meeting of January 27th. Any discussion on that? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Okay, with that, Ms. Kane, are you going to start first? Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, committee members, good morning. Again, my name is Linda Kane. I'm a project manager on the B3 project with the State Architect's Office.
We can't quite hear you. If you want to get a little closer there. Thank you.
Based on the legislation, the charge of the guidelines are to define indoor air quality, create and maintain a healthy environment, facilitate productivity improvements, specify ways to reduce material costs, consider the long-term operating costs of the building, including the use of renewable energy sources. There are a total of 46 guidelines, 35 of which are required and 11 that are recommended. The recommended guidelines are optional, and the required guidelines contribute to measurable outcomes. As an example of the difference, if you look at the guideline section on lighting, the energy efficiency and the quality of the lighting are required guidelines, while the amount of day lighting and view to a window, for example, are recommended guidelines. Another key concept of the guidelines is a connection to real outcomes that are performance-based, not prescriptive. The sustainable guidelines can be found on the website at the top of your screen. You can view online or download a copy of the guidelines. They're available to consultants for the documentation and implementation of the guidelines. The long version is approximately 240 pages, just to give you an idea. It's included in this binder here. And also, we do have a shorter version of 53 pages, sort of an executive summary that is easily printed out for your reference also. The guidelines are divided into the five sections you see on the screen. And just briefly, performance management is the process required to ensure that the guidelines are implemented by documenting decisions and monitoring systems throughout all phases of the project. Site and Water establishes requirements for minimizing erosion, sedimentation control, stormwater management, and water use reduction. Energy and Atmosphere provides guidance on mitigating the cost of energy. This is sort of the heart and soul of the guidelines. Energy consumption for building operations represents one-third of the total energy use in the state. The guidelines require 30% less energy use and recommend reduced emissions. The next section is indoor environmental quality, and these guidelines set high standards for indoor air quality and other interior environmental conditions to promote occupant health, well-being, and productivity. Materials and waste objectives are to guide selection and use of materials, products, and systems to construct buildings with the lowest life cycle costs and environmental impact. As Nikki mentioned earlier, sustainable guidelines of one sort or another have been around for many years. The LEED guidelines are the best known national guidelines. And for those of you who don't know, LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, and it was established by the U.S. Green Building Council. The Minnesota guidelines are compatible with LEED, but maintain regional values and priorities. With LEED, you earn credit. And you can get certified at all different levels, silver, gold, and platinum, depending on the number of credits that you earn. LEED doesn't take into account the variations in climate across the United States, and points don't have to be distributed across all building systems. Another distinguishing element is the Minnesota guidelines set up a process that will lead to a full accounting of the actual human, environmental, and life cycle economic costs and benefits of sustainable building design. In other words, by developing measurable guidelines, the benefits of sustainable design will be documented. The outcome documentation of the guidelines will demonstrate reductions in life cycle costs, operating costs, and maintenance costs, as well as improvements in employee productivity and environmental impact. The B3 consultants are presently working with design teams on 5 projects that are underway. These projects are for various state agencies and represent a variety of building types from throughout the state. By working with these design teams, the guidelines will be tested, and feedback from the consultants and user groups will be used to refine the guidelines. The next update of the guidelines is scheduled for June of 2005. I would now like to turn the presentation over to Rajan Thomas to discuss the benchmarking portion.
Thank you. Mr. Thomas, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rajan Thomas. I am an engineer with the Department of Administration, Plan Management Division, Energy Management Services Section. I will be responsible for the energy benchmarking part of this presentation. The public building energy benchmarking legislation was enacted by the 2001 legislature. It requires the Department of Administration to maintain energy-related information on all public buildings. The primary purpose of benchmarking is to identify public buildings performing poorer than average, in other words, to make a good list of bad buildings. The next step is to conduct a detailed energy audit for these inefficient buildings to implement the energy conservation measures necessary to make them energy efficient. This function will be performed by an energy expert who will conduct an on-site energy survey and will quantify energy conservation measures. Accurate energy benchmarking data will enable us to prioritize allocation of energy conservation funding for these public buildings. By doing this, we will maximize our energy cost savings. The next, this slide is a conceptual graph showing the value of energy benchmarking. The upper slope green straight line shows the average energy cost savings with benchmarking. The lower gray straight line shows the average energy cost savings without benchmarking. As you can see, a $10 million investment would generate approximately $15 million in energy cost savings over a 5-year period with benchmarking. In order to achieve the same $15 million in energy cost savings, we have to spend approximately $22 million in energy investment. Electrical and thermal energy performances of buildings are compared using 2 energy indexes. The annual electrical energy in kilowatt hour per square foot is used to benchmark electric energy use. Thermal energy performance is benchmarked using BTU or British thermal unit per square foot per year. It is also possible to combine the electrical and thermal energies by after converting both into a same in the common units such as BTU and then calculate the total energy in BTU per square foot per year. The next 2 slides I would like to discuss the status of the program. Department of Administration, in consultation with the Department of Commerce, prepared and presented a preliminary plan report to the legislature in 2002. The purpose of this preliminary plan report was to establish preliminary energy conservation goals and to set a stage for a comprehensive energy plan. The comprehensive energy plan detailing the steps necessary to implement energy conservation was developed in 2004. At present, we are collecting energy and building physical data from various public buildings entities to identify poor performing buildings. This task is scheduled to be completed by fiscal year 2006. Funding for implementation of energy efficiency improvements will be included in the future funding requests. That's all.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, that is our presentation. We'd be happy to take questions.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. A question from Representative Aaron Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to one of the testifiers, you were describing energy efficiency. I'm wondering, do these activities with utilities and such go through the SIP program? Is it on top of SIP? Does it include that type of oversight, or are these just free efficiencies that the state is benefiting from your activities on?
Who's going to answer that one? Want to bring somebody up? Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm going to bring up Janet Streff from the Department of Commerce, who is also a lead person, I believe, on the B3 project.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Janet Streff. I'm the manager of the State Energy Office in the Energy Division in the Department of Commerce. Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, the SIP program in this project is used only as a mechanism in which to obtain the funding up to $500,000 per year. We're using the same kind of assessment to obtain that money. This benchmarking is for is a process for all state and public buildings, so they may access once they had gone through the whole benchmarking or were doing improvements, they may access money through their utilities to help pay for that. Mm-hmm. That would be one mechanism for the sustainable building design. currently, Xcel Energy is the only utility who is using energy design assistance with their SIP funding, and that would also be one component where they would access SIP dollars to pay for that energy design assistance as they were using the sustainable design guideline.
Okay, that's good.
Okay, and a couple other questions here. First, Representative Neil Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this question is addressed to Ms. Kane at the State Architect's Office. In my life economically prior to my life now, I was involved in the commercial development business. And I remember sitting through a presentation that was made by three members of the architect's office. And the association group that I was sitting with, who were builders and engineers, kept muttering to themselves the concern they had that once the state architect's office got involved, that it began to bog the project down and slow down the development process. And what they were talking about is once you pull the trigger on a project to start the building, then you have to rev your project up to about 6,000 RPMs to make sure that things really go as quickly as possible and move quickly. And I guess I would ask the question of you, do you make an effort on your part in the architect's office to help that movement of activity once the project starts? And do you really try to tie into the development process with the contractors and the engineering and the scheduling so that you are a complement to that process and not a detriment?
Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, committee members, are you referring specifically to the sustainable guidelines?
Well, Madam Chair, five projects on the screen. One of them was Minnesota Housing Finance, one of them was a bank. There were like five projects that were in development process that you were referring to that we were working with your department. And so this memory sprung into my head that said, are you complementing that time process or are you hindering it? I'm being very candid.
Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, Representative. Currently, there is a B3 consultant team, and they have been involved with the project for the last 4 years. They put together the guidelines, and with the phase that we're in now, they are meeting with each of these projects, and they are assisting the design consultants with implementing the sustainable design guidelines. It's a kind of a win-win situation where they're assisting the consultants, but they're also getting feedback from the consultants for ways to streamline the collection of the information and the data that's really going to be critical to document the benefits of sustainable design guidelines. Within the structure of B3 at this point in time is that as the State Architect's Office hires consultants, as part of the requirement for them to come on board, they will be responsible for implementing the design guidelines. And they will collect the data, and they will appoint someone on that team to be the design leader in that, for that element. And the idea would be that they would fill out all the documentation, collect all the data, and it would reside with the project. And ultimately, it would be archived or kept at the University of Minnesota's Center for Sustainable Building Research.
Okay, another question, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I'm interested in the sustainable energy things. If you've done anything about lighting, have you done anything about energy-efficient lighting, and particularly non-polluting downward-facing lighting for state buildings?
Ms. Kane?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, yes, there is a specific section on lighting, and there are...
I'm sorry, I'm specifically, of course, talking about outdoor lighting.
Correct.
Outdoor lighting. Okay.
Correct.
Ms. King.
Madam Chair. If you look under the site and water category, there is something about light pollution.
Oh.
And so that is addressed. There are requirements regarding light pollution.
Okay.
Representative Kahn, I'm remembering some legislation
Yes.
you've done in the past. Maybe you want to describe it.
It's done this year, too. Actually, other states have passed it, you know, good red states like
So, just in case you think it's a liberal plot, I think Texas has passed it. Texas has also passed it. It's the concept of New Mexico, too. It's the concept of directing light downward, and you can there are dramatic energy savings involved, plus the fact that there's glare reduction on streets and so forth if the lighting is directed in the right direction. And then the final thing, which is that it helps preserve the night sky. And I believe that the city that has a city in Minneapolis that has a very good ordinance on this is the city of Maplewood, I believe, has an excellent had a city manager who is very interested in this issue and has a really good ordinance on it. So I thought, for a start, I have had the bill in. Haven't gotten a hearing on it, you know, for the state, and for the state, I think, to draw up a model ordinance for this. But it has no downward side. And of course, the worst violator of this, I think, and I just looked at some article in our local newspaper, is the city of Minneapolis, and I think the worst lights on this state or in front of my house. aside from all that, it's not only cost saving, it's really good for the environment. So I would hope at least that the state, and you know, I don't know who I should talk to. Should I talk to you about you know, just making sure that the state at least has, in our own rules, has those best. And I think I did talk to the people in state parks, where it's particularly important for the preservation of the night sky, I think. But I did talk, and they've kind of assured me that all their lighting is done with that. And, you know, but I'd like something other than just verbal assurances if that's what's happening. So,
Ms. Dean.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the beauty of the guidelines is that they really are a living document, and as technology changes and more data comes in, they will be updated. And I would be happy to talk with you in more detail about what's in there at this time and to receive any information that you have that
Great.
Other states are implementing.
Thank you. We have a question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and our guests from administration. I'm just really impressed and pleased that the state's trying to be a leader as it's developing new state public buildings. But I have a question. Are we using these standards in any way to evaluate potential rental properties? It seems to me that we've increased over the years the amount of lease space that state government uses, and I think to the degree that we can influence and or reward the private market for evidencing these kind of priorities and values, I think that would be useful. Is that used at all in the selection of lease space?
Ms. Kane?
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, Presently, the guidelines require that any building receiving funding for new construction or new building after January 2004 is required to implement these guidelines. However, that does not stop someone from utilizing them, and that can be part of the requirement for any type of remodeling or leasehold space that's renovated. And one of the major tenets of sustainability is to not build new, but to make do with what you have.
Other questions? Well, I have a question, just kind of the big picture look on all this. Assistant Commissioner, I understand you're new to the position, and congratulations for being hired there. Just wondering, kind of the whole big concept of this is to look at the, you know, long-term costs of buildings and do some savings. Do you have any information put together as far as, you know, 10 years from now, what can we see for, you know, benefits to the state as far as any costs or other kind of big picture issues with this? Maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but we could talk later, too. Assistant Commissioner.
I'll be honest. I really don't know. Linda possibly has a little bit.
Sure. Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, some of the figures that are coming in now from data that's being collected in other states shows that the projections are that for an upfront investment of roughly 2 to 0%, you could realize a life cycle savings of 20% over the 75-year life of a building. So that's 10 times the initial investment. As an example, investing upfront an additional $100,000 on your HVAC system or insulation on a $5 million project would result in $1 million savings over the life of the building. I mean, there's also some, if you want to look at it in a square foot basis, there's a study that's just come out from California that shows that an initial investment of an additional $3 to $5 per square foot over a 20-year period could result in savings of $16 per square foot. And if you want to look at reduction in operating costs, the guidelines call for a 30% reduction in energy usage. And the projections right now are showing that this should result in a 3-year payback on a small building and as quick as a 1-year payback on larger buildings.
Thank you. You know, maybe if we could get a copy of that information at some point, if you could submit it, and we'll get copies for the committee. Question, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Keene, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. The numbers that you just cited, does that include the cost of the higher cost of maintenance for these environmental systems?
Ms. Keene?
Madam Chair, I guess I'm not clear on your question. Because they're more sophisticated?
Yes.
And Ms. Keene?
Madam Chair, I do not have that kind of information before me, and I'm not sure.
I don't have any additional information there.
Well, Ms. Mahoney and Ms. Kane, it'd be nice for the committee to know if we're going to be bringing any of this stuff forward, either now or in the future, to have that kind of built in there, because the sophistication of many of these environmental systems does drive the cost of maintenance, whether it's for the first year or for the next 20 years, in many different ways. And I certainly understand the cost of ownership and building a building and then looking at the out years of savings. But many of these buildings that, you know, particularly when we're renting them, they change ownership. So I have some concerns in the initial cost, and then, you know, why would someone who's building them, and I suspect that a developer would have to come in and tell us, why would you build it, put all these extra added features in, when you don't really care about maintenance down the road or cost down the road, because you're just building it and then going to sell it off or lease it and let your tenant take care of it. So that's something for a developer to come in and talk about, but certainly something for this committee to look at when we add the cost of building a building.
Thank you. Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair, the only thing I'd add is that right now it is just required for buildings receiving public funding. So it's primarily state buildings, and then, for example, buildings like the zoo and Guthrie, building, projects of that nature.
Thank you. Question from Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I believe my question is for Ms. Kane. You made a reference that you'd like to keep buildings as opposed to building new. Can you expand on how that relates to the Ford building across the street?
Ms. Kane.
Madam Chair. Well, I think that I'm assuming that it's already been done, or we would go in and do a cost-benefit analysis. And basically you would go in there and look at the elements of the building that need to be rebuilt, refurbished, redone, and you would weigh that against the total value of the property or its potential for either resale or lease. But there certainly is a way to go in there and really quantify that. And I believe some of those instruments are within the design guidelines.
Follow-up, Representative McNamara.
Ms. Kane, can you answer, and if you don't know it now, I guess I would like to have you give it to the committee, because specifically when we look at that building, and many of us toured it yesterday, we question the wisdom to tear it down. And I guess just my question specifically is, how in the criteria process did this come up to be demoed instead of to be reused, to be saved?
Actually, if I could interject, and represent McNamara, that was the Capital Investment Committee that you toured?
Correct. I'm sorry,
okay.
Madam Chair. Yes.
Ms. King.
Madam Chair, I'm not familiar enough with that project to comment on it, and I'm not sure if anyone on our team is here today.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative, I feel like the best way I can even address that is just to say that on an economic level, where the Ford building came out in terms of rehab cost, that was our driver for the decision. And I think in every project you would look at it in that way. You know, the sustainability guidelines are being developed for, as Linda Kane mentioned, projects using new state money. I don't know that you can exactly compare that to Ford, because again, what we were looking at with the Ford building on our recommendation was simply a matter of economics. That's where it came out. Now, that's not to say that, you know, we could spend $9 to $26 million on the Ford building, and we would be using sustainable, probably some of the concepts in that to do it. But I think just to answer your question fairly and honestly, it's to say, it's not a new building. It's old. It's in need of major repairs and renovation, and economics is what led us to that decision.
Thank you. See no further questions. I just want to drop in a comment here. Appreciate this information. I think, you know, looking at things long-term is something that maybe the legislature doesn't do often enough, and so it's nice to see that admin is taking this long-term look at the use of our buildings, because I think there's some real possibilities there for some cost savings, some more efficient things. And, you know, as we deal with things that developing new power plants and other things for our state, you know, perhaps conservation can be better used in all ways across the state. And, you know, encourage you to keep moving on this, and, you know, I'd be interested in any cost savings along the line. I just have one quick question. You know, we got the one handout that talked about the sustainable guidelines, and under realistic, you have the 30% better than energy code objective, and I guess I'm just wondering kind of how you came up with that 30%, because I work a lot with K-12 school buildings in the state, and they're looking at driving the architects to do 50% better. So I'm wondering, was that a random number? Was there some reason for coming up with 30% rather than a higher number? Ms. Kane?
Madam Chair, I was not involved with on this committee at its inception, and I thought that they were looking for something that was very doable, would be my understanding of that, and I'm not sure if there's anyone in the audience that was involved at that point, but I can get a better answer for you on that.
Yeah, perhaps if we could talk about that in the future, I could just set up a meeting with all three of you and discuss this further, because I think, you know, we could maybe be pushed a little bit more, and I think that would help the whole industry across the state looking at savings. So thank you for your presentation today, and I especially appreciate you coming back from the other day. So thank you very much. Okay, members, next up is the Minnesota State Board of Investment, and I think you have, is it one or two handouts? One handout in the packet? Mr. Bicker. And members, just a reminder, we're going to hope to finish up committee today 11:15, 11:20 or so. And then we'll be back tomorrow for two bills, including House File 1, which should be kind of a, I don't know if it'll be lengthy, the Representative Zeller bills having to do with sexual predators. We're going to be seeing it because of one small provision in the bill. I think it's a quite large bill, but it'll be the first hearing on the bill, and then we'll be moving it to another committee. So you get a chance to take a look at that. Otherwise, we'll have the bill here in committee tomorrow. So with that, Mr. Bicker, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Howard Bicker. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Board of Investment. I'm here this morning to give you a very brief and quick overview of the State Board of Investment and then hopefully answer any questions you may have. In the handout I've given you, page one, the State Board of Investment is really the four statewide constitutional officers. The governor is the chair of the State Board of Investment. The other three members are the state auditor, the secretary of state, and the attorney general. The State Board of Investment is formed by the Constitution. There's a constitutional provision that formed the State Board of Investment and set its board. And then our authority to invest and who we invest for is set on a statutory basis in Chapter 11A and some of our fiduciary responsibilities in 356A. Page three is some background on the Investment Advisory Council. We have an advisory council that advises both the staff and the board on investment policy-related matters. 10 of the 17 members are from the local investment community, the pension people from, you know, like 3M and Cargill and General Mills and so on and so forth. In addition to those members, the directors of the three statewide retirement systems serve on the advisory council, as does the commissioner of finance, and then there's two active and one retired employee appointed by the governor. The board and the advisory council meet on a quarterly basis, and I have a staff of 20. Page 4 gives a list of the assets that the State Board of Investment is responsible for. Most times when you think of State Board of Investment, you think of retirement-related assets, and the majority of our assets are retirement-related. As you can see, the basic retirement funds, which is the fund for active employees, and the post-retirement fund, which is the fund for retired employees, is a significant portion of the assets under which for which we manage. In addition to that, we do a number of things. We have something called the Supplemental Investment Funds, which are basically a group of seven mutual funds that are available for various volunteer police and fire organizations and some supplemental investment options. We run the state's deferred comp plan, which is a 457 plan. Some of you who come from private world, you have a 401k, state government's a 457. And then we invest a number of non-retirement related accounts. We invest the treasurer's portfolio, which is the state's general revenue accounts, and the highway funds. We invest the permanent school fund, the earnings of which help offset school aids. We invest the environmental trust fund, which is the revenue from the state lottery. We do the assigned risk plan, which is part of the state's workers' comp system. We do the debt service, housing finance, and so on and so forth. Page 5 gives you a little idea of our pension investment policy. When we invest pension funds, we look long-term. We are 20, 30-year time horizons when we're looking for pension assets. By statute, our return assumption is 8.5%. So if we make 8.5% over the long run, assuming there's sufficient contributions in the pension plan, we should be fully funded. And we've set long-term asset allocations, which you can see on page 5. We have 45% of the portfolio in domestic equities, 15% international equities, and the balance in bonds and alternative investments. Alternative investments are venture capital, private equities, real estate, oil and gas, and those types of things. Page 6 gives you a little background on the returns that we have generated over the years. What we have here are the returns for the basic funds, the post, and the combined funds. Just to be able to help you read the page, the under year one, it says basic funds total. The basics earned 16.6% over the last fiscal year. And when it says composite benchmark, that is the return of the asset allocation that we have set up. So in other words, if we passively manage, just got the returns of the stock market, the returns of the bond market, and so on and so forth, if you could perfectly index that, you would have had 16.3. Now, the reality is you can index a lot of those, but there are still some costs related to indexing. So the reality is the composite index, if we would have invested strictly in passive management, which we do a significant amount of, we would have probably been 16.2, 16.1. So that is kind of our benchmark. How are we doing? You can see over long periods of time, over the last 20 years, the basics have returned 11.3% on an annualized basis, which is significantly more than 8.5% that is required by statute. This also includes the wonderful periods of 2001 and 2002, where we had dot-com phenomena that went and blew up the markets, plus 9/11 and a number of the corporate scandals. So we look to invest these assets for the long term. We're going to have short periods of market volatility, as we went through. And we're going to have good years and we're going to have bad years. But on average, the board has done a better than benchmark returns for both the basics and the post. And that gives you, Mr. Chairman and members, a quick overview of the State Board of Investment. And if there are any questions, I'd gladly try to respond.
Representative McNair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, can you do you know the percent we build in? You said you use it 8.5%, and when we hear of the shortfalls in some of the different plans, is that based on a future 8.5, or is it based on more what you've really received over the years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if you're talking about the statewide plans, TRA, PERA, and MSRS, they're all based on 8.5% assumed rate of return.
Follow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you know, do they ever present to us what it would be if we use, say, the 9.5 that might be a more conservative, realistic, long-term approach, what those numbers would be?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I mean, 9.5, if you use a number like that, would obviously take care of some of the unfunded liability because you're going to assume a higher rate of return. The reality is many entities are going down and not up with their actuarial assumed rates. This has been a pretty good time period over the last 20 years in the financial markets, and 11.3% is a pretty good number. When we do our modeling for asset allocation, our expected return using historical returns and various correlations is in the 9.5% area. If you wanted to go to 9.5, you would be very much on the high side. Most public entities are 7.5 to 8.5 area.
Representative Tom?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bicker, I'm a little bit, the post funds I would have assumed would have been a much more conservative investment. I would assume that they didn't have a lot in dot-com, and I'm surprised that they seem to be as affected by the downturn in the 3-year and 5-year projections. Why didn't those post funds do better than the funds that are a little bit more aggressive? Or weren't the post funds more?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, the post is not more conservatively set up than the active employees fund. And that has been since the formula was changed to a total rate of return in 1991 and 92. The post has had historically somewhat of a lower alternative investment component. and that was based on some of the formulas, but that has gradually increased over the years. Alternative investments have been the best performing asset class that the state board has.
And in that, Mr. Chairman, in that 3-year and 5-year?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman and Representative Cowan, I didn't understand your question.
In the last 2 years and the last 3 years?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Chairman, let me also throw in foreign investments, too. In terms of, is foreign investments a part of the alternative investments too, aren't they?
Representative Khan and Mr. Vicker, maybe you could explain for the rest of the committee what you mean by alternative investment. So that might help us out.
Okay. Mr. Chairman and members, first of all, we have a separate allocation, as I showed on page 5 for international. International is 50% of the portfolio for both the basics and the puffs. International investments, especially over the last year and a half, have done extremely well, especially because of the devaluation of the dollar and the strength of the euro. Alternative investments for us are basically limited partnerships that invest in venture capital, private equity, real estate, and various oil and gas, mezzanine debt, non-traditional type investments. We have been doing these types of investments since the early 1980s, and they have provided a strong return for the state and have also provided good diversification for the state.
So, Mr. Bigger, now, Representative Khan, could you ask your question?
Well, essentially the question is, as I understand it, in the past, you know, when the stock market turned down, more conservative investments did better than less conservative investments. And I'm a little surprised, because I would have thought, I'm also a little surprised to hear you say that the post fund isn't a more conservative investment. Is that traditional?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Penn,
public pension fund policy?
Excuse me.
That's traditional public pension fund policy?
We went to the 5-year smoothing average of the post in 1991. That gave the post the opportunity to have a more aggressive stance, very similar to the active employees, because you have a longer term time horizon. Prior to that law change, when the post formula was based strictly on yield and it had a significant bond component, because of the yield, it had a significant bond component. If that legislation had not been changed, we would have probably left $4 or $5 billion on the table, because the post would not have appreciated in the equity markets during the 90s. It was down to about 10% equities. So that legislation in the early 90s was a very significant piece of legislation. And the post investments, when we operate at the State Investment Board, we have a equity portfolio that everybody participates in. There is not a equity portfolio for the teachers, there's not one for PERA, there's not one for retired lives, there's not one for... We have one equity operation for efficiency purposes, and everybody utilizes the same kind of stock portfolio. We do the same thing with bonds, and we do the same thing with international. It's extremely efficient, and it allows us to operate at much reduced cost. So the returns from an equity standpoint for the basics and the post will be exactly the same. The returns for the bonds will be exactly the same, and the returns for international will be exactly the same. The difference in their returns are twofold. One, they have slightly different asset allocations, and two, they have different cash flow characteristics. The post obviously has a significant outflow on a monthly basis. The annuity payments that the state makes from the post-retirement fund are somewhere in $140 million a month is the payroll. So we must have a higher cash balance in the post-retirement fund to allow us in the retirement systems to send out those checks. So therefore, the post will have a higher cash allocation, which currently is 3%, versus the basics having a frictional cash allocation of 1%. And the post has had a slightly lower alternative component over the years, and that has been gradually increased up to now it's at 12 versus the basics at 15.
Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bicker, what about private money managers? Do you tell us how much of this is being done by private money managers? And how do you judge? Do you keep the same ones all the time, or do you make judgments on performance? Do you change them back and forth? First, I guess I'd like to know what proportion, how many money managers you have, and what you do about decisions about keeping them on or changing them.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members, the State Board of Investment, we run approximately $7 billion inside, the balance of which is we retain external organizations to do the investment management functions for us. A significant portion of what we manage is in what's known as index fund and or risk control management, just because of the size of the assets we have. In domestic equities, for example, one-third of it is a straight index fund. One-third of it's risk controlled. In other words, we set parameters that will set in advance how much deviation these managers will be able to make to the market, and about a third of it is actively managed. Now, we, on an ongoing basis, monitor the performance of all of these managers, whether they're stock managers, bond managers, international, so on and so forth. We report their performance on a quarterly basis to the board and to the advisory council. We publish the returns, obviously, in our annual report. So we have an ongoing process whereby we monitor managers. We are always hiring and or terminating managers. Some years there are more, some years there are less.
Okay.
Representative,
Madam Chairman, the $7 billion is, and I guess this is in this information, so I can pick it up. The $7 billion is what proportion of your? The $7 billion is done by active managers. Well, $7 billion is the total, and one third of that is done by active.
$7 billion is managed by our internal staff.
Okay.
The balance of which about $40 billion is externally managed.
So $7 billion. $7 billion is your staff, and $40 billion is externally managed.
Well, and we obviously
and of those two, is that one third, one third, one third for both of those characteristics?
The internal, Madam Chair and Representative Khan, internal management is all the non-retirement related assets and some of these specialized accounts because of the nature of how they are run. We, by law, cannot commingle retirement and non-retirement assets for various tax reasons and whatnot. So, therefore, the retirement-related assets, the assets in the post-retirement fund and the assets in the basic retirement funds, are, for the most part, managed externally. The state's general revenue accounts, permanent school fund, some of the environmental trust fund, IRRRB, and so on and so forth, for the most part, are managed internally.
Okay, we have a couple other questions that we need to wrap up. Next on the list is Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't sure you had seen my hand up there. Well, okay. I have that last question brings up another question for me, but first let me go back to my original reason for raising my hand just so that I can be clear. Who sets the investment policy? Is this set by statute, or is it set by the board and the advisory council?
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Representative, there are very, very broad parameters established by statute. In other words, we can't have more than 85% of our entire portfolio in equities, and there's various restrictions in law. So, to some degree, you know, the legislature has overall control about what we can do, and they set certain parameters about what we can invest in. The actual, you know, 45% is set by a process whereby staff and the Investment Advisory Council do thorough reviews, and they ultimately is voted on and decided by the board.
Okay. And then,
thank
you, Madam Chair. Representative Khan's question made me wonder, can you give us an idea about management costs? I mean, it sounds now you're using a lot of external managers, and you mentioned on here that you have a staff of 20. So how does all that work out?
Madam Chair and Representative, our entire cost, including external management fees and our budget, are less than 10 basis points, another one-tenth of 1%.
Thank you.
Final question, Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker, can I assume then, and I need to just yes or no answer, the legislature then is accountable.
Representative Dempsey, we can't hear you. Can you pull the mic up, please?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Bicker, is the legislature accountable then for the investments made by the board?
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Representative, I mean, the board is accountable for its investments.
And Madam Chair?
Representative Dempsey.
Give me an example of what that means.
Well, I mean,
Mr. Bicker.
Madam Chair and Representative, I mean, we report our performance and how the funds have, you know, what returns we have generated on an ongoing quarterly basis, you know, formally on an annual report on an annual basis. So, I mean, I am and my staff is and the board is responsible for and have been charged with the responsibility of investing these various state assets.
And one final question.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bicker, let's say you make some poor investments and you are $300 million in debt. Who's held accountable? Are you held accountable and your people, or does the state bail out the malfeasance?
Madam Chair and Representative, if I had $300 million to bail you out, I wouldn't be here. but the reality is that I think the state government have a lot of people doing a lot of different jobs, and if any of those people, including me, or building a bridge or whatever, don't do their jobs, ultimately, they come back to the state.
That's what I wanted to know, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to be closing here. I just wanted to thank you, Mr. Bicker, for coming to the committee. Appreciate that. There's a couple of items, members, in your packets from today. There's an updated list of the membership on the committee, which reflects our new member here, Representative Mahoney, and then also a handout from the Department of Employee Relations answering some questions from the January 12th hearing. So tomorrow we've got a couple of bills up, and with that, members, meeting is adjourned.